She had not regretted a moment. "Go," Jet told Franny. "What's meant to happen will." Franny stored her toothbrush and an extra t-shirt in her backpack, then had Lewis climb into the cat's carrying case, for it was too miserable a night to fly such a long distance. She took a cab to Penn Station and bought a ticket on the first train to Boston. The car was overcrowded, and Franny had to stand until they reached New Haven, when she could finally slide into an available seat. By then, she had a deep sense of foreboding. The other passengers must have felt it as well. As crowded as the train was, no one would sit next to her. When she got to Boston, she let Lewis out of his case, and he lit into the sky. She stopped at a shop outside South Station and bought a bag of jelly donuts, then took a taxi to Mass General. This time she knew she would be questioned about her relationship to the patient. When she said she was his sister, she was told that Hay had suffered from appendicitis. His roommate had found him curled up in a fetal position, teeth chattering, unable to respond, and had frantically called an ambulance. It was touch and go, the nurse divulged as she led Franny along the hall. They had feared septic shock, and Halen was still weak. He was in a shared room, which meant Franny had to edge past the man in the bed closest to the door. He was exceedingly old, and she could tell he was dying. There was a dark circle tightening around him like a shroud, instant by instant. Franny paused to take his hand, and the old man clutched at her, grateful. "Are you here to see me?" he asked. "Will you say goodbye to me?" "Of course," Franny assured him. Halen had been dozing, but he rose up through his half-sleep, brought fully awake by the sound of Franny's voice. He was pale and much thinner. There was the dark stubble of a beard on his face. The old man now soothed, Franny went on to Halen's bed. She dumped her backpack on the floor and lay down beside him, careful not to disturb the IV tubing inserted into his vein. She circled her arms around him. "Franny," he said, "you came." "Of course," she said. "It's always been us," Halen said. Franny told him how Lewis had come to the city to fetch her. "He's never really liked me," she said. "He's always preferred you." "You're wrong," Halen told her. "He's crazy about you. I have a photograph of you on my desk, and he sits there and stares at it, lovesick." Hay chuckled, then clutched at his abdomen in pain. Franny had brought along a protection spell. She tied a blue string that had been coated with lavender oil around Halen's wrist, then kissed his open hand. "Is this to bring me back to you?" he asked.
"It's to make you well."
She delivered the bag of jelly donuts, which brought a grin to Halen's face.
"You remembered." "Of course I did."
Hay then launched into praising Cambridge, how much Franny would appreciate the narrow streets and the riverside. She could take a class or two at Radcliffe. They could get an apartment in Central Square. He had been taking extra courses and planned to graduate a year early so they would have more time to spend together. She submitted to this dream of happiness, but only briefly, until she gazed out the window. The crow was on the windowsill, watching, his head tilted. He knew what she was thinking. She was too afraid of the curse to ever place Halen in danger. Franny slipped off the bed. It was too difficult to be near him. She poured Halen a cup of water. "Franny," he said, "we were meant to be together. Your coming here proves it." She had no idea what she would do next, if she would stay or go. "You can't leave me now," Hay urged. And she might have said she would never leave him again, but just then a tall blonde girl stepped into the room, breaking their intimacy. The girl was perhaps 20, pretty, with a huge smile, her cheeks flushed from walking along the Charles River, which she complained about as soon as she arrived. Her sleek cap of hair was in place, despite the windy day. She wore a plaid skirt and a blue cashmere sweater and a scarf knotted at her throat. She, too, carried a bag of jelly donuts. "I'm freezing," the girl declared. "And oh my God, hey, I was out of my mind with worry last night."
She went to Halen's side. I didn't even get to call your parents until this morning. They'll be up tonight. She pulled off her scarf. I didn't leave here until the doctor assured me 100% that you were fine.
I am, he said roughly, his eyes still on Franny.
The girl had been so intent on Hay, she hadn't even noticed Franny lurking by the window, wearing her ill-fitting black coat. Oh, hello, the girl said brightly. I didn't see you there. Lewis tapped on the window glass, but Franny was distracted. Her heart was pounding. She'd gone white as a sheet, her freckles splotchy across her pale face. Hello, she said. Her voice cracked with the fever of resentment. The girl came forward and stuck out her hand. I'm Emily Flood. Being in such close proximity to this interloper caused a series of images to flicker behind Franny's eyes. You're from Connecticut and you went to an all-girls private school and you're Halen's roommate.
Why, yes. How did you know all that?
I'm not officially a roommate, but since I'm there every night, I guess so. It's a good thing I am. Otherwise, who would have called the ambulance?
Hay is so stoic. He would have shivered there uncomplaining until his appendix burst.
Oh, Franny said. It was you who saved him.
Franny, Halen seemed truly in pain now.
Emily looked at Hay, then at Franny. You're Franny? I've heard so much about you, how brilliant you are.
Well, I'm not. I'm actually stupid.
Franny went to retrieve the backpack she dropped on the floor when she climbed into bed with Halen.
And I've overstayed my welcome.
Hay got out of bed, gripping his side, lurching forward so that the IV stand nearly toppled. Emily caught the IV and righted it, but no one was paying much attention to her.
Franny, do not leave, Hay said.
Things changed. You were gone for 2 years.
He had the nerve to reproach her with Emily Flood standing right there. If that pretty roommate of Hay's spoke to her again, she couldn't be held accountable for her actions.
That's right, Franny said. I didn't get to go to school. I couldn't be your roommate.
She went to the door, past the dying man. The shroud was almost completely encircling him now, but he murmured his gratitude when Franny stopped to touch his forehead. She stayed until he had passed over. It was so brief, like a sigh. Then she went on, despite Hay calling out to her. She ran all the way to South Station, her heart thudding against her chest.
Emily. His roommate.
Well, what had she expected? She had sent him off. She had told him to go and not to look back. On the train, Franny smoldered with fury and hurt. At Penn Station, she cut a path through the crowd and walked home in the dark. That night, she cried tears so black they stained the sheets. She didn't change out of the clothes she'd worn when she was beside Halen in bed. They still carried his scent. In the morning, she went into the garden. Jet spied her sister from the kitchen window. She went outside and they sat together on the back steps. Snow had begun to fall, but the sisters remained where they were.
He found someone else, Franny said. There will never be anyone else. Well, there is. Her name is Emily. She's his roommate.
Only because you told him to go.
Either way, she's the one who has him.
Oh, it was horrible. Franny was crying. She was mortified. She quickly buried her face in her hands.
I let him go, and now he belongs to someone else. And it's better for him that way.
You can love him if you want to, Jet told Franny.
The scar on her face bloomed in cold weather, turning the color of violets.
To hell with the curse. You don't have to make the same mistakes all the other women in our family have made.
Why would I be any different?
You'll be the one to outsmart it.
Unlikely,
Franny said sadly.
You will, Jet insisted.
She didn't have to have the sight to know this. Wait and see. April Owens arrived on a Greyhound bus on a bright spring day in 1966
and walked to the village from 42nd Street. It had been nearly 6 years since she had first met Franny and Jet and Vincent, but somehow it had felt as though she'd known them forever, so it made perfect sense to show up in New York without bothering to write or call. It was a long walk, but she didn't mind. All she wanted was to be free. Every mortal being was entitled to that right, no matter what her history might be. April was still fierce, but now she was most fierce in her devotion to her daughter. She didn't mind when Regina, only 5 and usually very good-humored, grew tired and cranky by the time they passed Pennsylvania Station and had to be carried the rest of the way. Regina was dressed in a t-shirt and a gauzy little skirt that she referred to as her princess outfit, but now she was an exhausted princess. She fell asleep in her mother's arms, heavier in sleep than she had been while awake. No matter. April kept going. She was wearing jeans and a fringed vest, and her long pale hair was in braids, bound with beaded leather ties. She stood out in Midtown among a sea of suits and proper dresses, but as she headed downtown, she looked like anybody else on the street. She found number 44 Greenwich and rang the bell. She liked what she saw. The tilted house, the trees in the garden, the shop that sold enchantments, the schoolyard next door where scores of children were out at play. When Jet threw open the door, she embraced April and her daughter, who resembled Franny, though her hair was as black as Jet's and Vincent's. For the first time since Levi's death, Jet felt a bit of happiness when she looked into the face of the little girl. She wasn't even grumpy to have been woken and introduced to a stranger. She was very serious, and she shook Jet's hand and said,
"Very nice to meet you."
"I can't believe how big Regina is, and how polite. Are you sure she's an Owens?"
"She most assuredly is."
"You should have told us you were coming for a visit. I would have prepared something special. Now the house is a mess."
"That's immaterial. And this is not a visit, dear Jet. It's a jailbreak."
April had an overstuffed backpack and a duffel bag, both of which she deposited on the couch in the parlor. There were dark circles under her eyes, and she appeared drained. "My parents want to take Reggie from me. They want her to grow up on Beacon Hill and go to a private school in a chauffeured car. It's everything I don't want for her. Everything I wanted to escape from. They said they'd fight me in court if they had to. I think they've already retained a lawyer. So I'm headed to California. Let them try to find me there. This is just a pit stop. I hope you don't mind."
"You know you can stay as long as you'd like."
Franny came in from the garden with a basket of herbs she had just picked, comfrey, mint, and, though it was not as often needed these days due to the birth control pill, pennyroyal. City soot had veined the herbs' leaves black, so Franny always had to soak them in cold water and vinegar in the big kitchen sink. She stopped in her tracks when she saw the little girl. Regina looked up at her and smiled.
"You're the good witch," she said.
Franny laughed. She'd certainly never thought of herself that way. Still, she was charmed.
"Have you ever heard of a tipsy cake?" she asked.
Regina shook her head no.
"Why, it's absolutely delicious. It's the most chocolatey chocolate you'll ever taste. I think I'll make you one."
Franny nodded a greeting when April came into the kitchen in search of Regina. She thought their cousin looked the worse for the wear, with her pale hair lifeless and her already slender frame now excessively thin.
"We're just about to make a tipsy cake, but I'll leave out the rum," Franny said, "for Regina's sake. I must say, this is a surprise. But then that's your style, isn't it? Just show up out of nowhere."
"I won't impose, Franny. I just need a night. We're leaving for California tomorrow. I've got a ride on something called the Sorcerer's Apprentice, a van that goes cross-country." The little girl shivered when California was mentioned. She was so sensitive she seemed a walking prediction, as if she had the sight times 2.
"You don't think you'll like California?" Franny asked the child.
"Maybe, but I know what happens there."
"Which is?" Franny pressed.
"Well, people die,"
the little girl said.
"For goodness sake," April said, People die everywhere.
You should avoid California, Franny told her cousin. She has a premonition. There are better places to raise your daughter.
You sound like my mother. Say whatever you want. I've made up my mind. I've got my degree from MIT despite my mother's protests. Biology. That's what I've been doing for the past 4 years. I have a friend at a geo lab in Palm Desert. I can work there and Regina can be safe for a while.
Jet came in to make tea.
Safe from what?
April glanced over at Franny, who was studying the child.
You see it, don't you?
Franny did.
There was a halo around Regina that usually indicated a shortened lifespan. Such people seemed more alive when they were young, filled with light. She had never told a soul that Vincent had had the same halo around him when he was a baby, and perhaps this was why she'd always been so protective of him. Regina sat cross-legged on the floor to play with Wren.
She's got gray eyes, Mama, like us.
Of course, Franny told the little girl. That's because she's an Owens cat.
When it came down to it, Franny was sorry she and April always had quarreled. She wished she could console her cousin, but there was no way to skirt around some things. Not when they both had the sight.
I want her to have a happy life, a free life, April said, resigned. I'm going to do everything I can to see that she gets it.
She'll find that in California. People are more open there, not so quick to judge.
Jet had collected a pile of books for the child.
I really don't know what you two are talking about.
April turned to observe Jet.
You've lost the sight. Maybe that's for the best.
I had no choice in the matter, Jet said. My fate wasn't what I thought it would be.
I know what that feels like, April said in the soft voice, just as the front door was falling open.
Vincent had arrived. Jet had telephoned and insisted he come to dinner. Hearing his cousin's voices, he now knew why. He wandered in with his dog at his heels and bowed to April.
To what do we owe this visit?
Bad luck and the need to run away.
It's always the same story, Vincent said with a grin. Parent trouble.
You know so much and yet so little, April remarked.
No one mentioned Vincent's involvement with William. Franny, because she didn't think to do so, and Jet, because she knew it would be painful news for April. She wanted this evening to be a happy time, and it was exactly that. Thankfully, April had never had the ability to get inside Vincent's head. Regina took to him, just as she had when she was a baby. After dinner, she begged him to read aloud from Half Magic by Edward Eger, her favorite book, and he obliged. Vincent thought the novel was advanced for her age, but Regina was not a typical child. She had taught herself to read and always carried a book with her. Vincent was especially funny when he acted out the dialogue of a cat that was half real and could only half talk. Regina was soon enough in fits of bright laughter. Vincent's dog was at his feet, his shadow, silent and dignified and more than a little mortified when Regina laid her cuddly stuffed bunny rabbit beside him.
I call her Maggie, Regina said.
Do you? Vincent said, giving April a grin. What did you expect her to call it? Mrs. Russell? April teased.
How did you know about that?
Vincent asked. Then he saw a look exchanged between April and Jet.
Does everyone know all the details of my life?
Not all, Jet said. Hardly anything, April assured him. When the chocolate cake was ready, they had it hot from the oven, served with mounds of vanilla ice cream.
Am I allowed to have that? Regina asked.
Of course, Vincent told her.
Always remember, he whispered. Live a lot.
Regina ate most of her cake.
You can have the rest, she told Vincent,
as she set to work on a drawing of Harry and Wren. In her rendering, the two were best friends who held each other's paws. Vincent was charmed by the child, but when he glanced at his watch, he stood up.
I'm late, he said.
for a very important date, April said, blinking. Indeed, Vincent said. I'm involved with someone. Don't tell me you actually care about someone. We're not supposed to, are we? Vincent joked. No, April said. We're not. Vincent grinned and kissed the little girl goodbye on the forehead, then went out with his dog, two shadows spilling into the night. See you when I see you, he called over his shoulder.
See you when I see you,
Regina called back.
He's still the same, April said.
Not completely, Jet said. There was no need to go into details and hurt April any more than she already was.
Vincent is Vincent, thank goodness,
Franny said as she started in on the dishes. April shook her head. She pulled her daughter onto her lap.
Will he ever grow up?
Yes, Jet said. And we'll be sad when he does. In the morning, the cousins were gone. Regina's drawing of a black dog and a black cat had been left on the kitchen table. Franny had it framed later that afternoon, and from then on she kept it in the parlor, and even years later, when she moved and left almost everything behind, she took it with her, bundled in brown paper and string.
Part 4. Elemental.
She saw Halen walking down the path. At first she thought she had conjured him, and perhaps he was a ghostly image of himself, but no, it was Hay. He was so tall she spotted him right away, wearing the same denim jacket he'd had since he was 15. Franny sat on the rock, knees to chest. She was a mess and damned herself for being so. The last time she'd seen him, she'd caused a scene in the hospital. Now she vowed to be calm and collected. She had lost him, so her heart shouldn't be thudding against her chest. It was over, and she should be happy that he had been saved from throwing in his lot with an Owens woman. She wore old sneakers and jeans and a black and white striped t-shirt she'd found in the 99-cent bin at the thrift store where they'd sold their mother's beautiful clothes. She hadn't even brushed her hair that morning. Halen spied her and waved, as if they'd seen each other only hours before. He came to sit beside her. Don't tell me you've been waiting here all these years. Franny laughed out loud. Hay smiled, pleased he could make her laugh. But his hurt made him say more. I know you haven't been waiting for me. I've come here every time I'm home and you're never here. So I gave up on us. Franny threw a hand over her mouth as if holding back a sob. Her eyes were rimmed with tears. Franny. He hadn't really wanted to hurt her.
I'm not crying, if that's what you think,
Franny responded, wiping her nose on her sleeve. I know that. Do you think I'm an idiot? They both laughed then. Don't answer that, Hay said with a grin. He was attending Yale Medical School, Franny's father's alma mater. It made perfect sense that he would become a doctor. He had always wanted to do good in the world. And it made sense, too, when he revealed he'd placed distance between himself and his family. I don't go home anymore, he said, morose as he always was when thinking about his heritage. It's like a fucking mausoleum with my father getting richer on the war, and my mother drinking so she won't go berserk because she's married to him.
Where do you stay when you come to New York?
When Hay glanced away, Franny knew.
Oh.
She could barely bring herself to say it.
With Emily.
You remember her name, he said, surprised.
Of course I do. Emily Flood, your roommate.
You don't usually take note of people. He flushed when Franny threw him a deadly look. Well, you don't.
Of course I took note of her, Halen. How could I not?
Yeah. Hay said, feeling more like an idiot than ever.
So where is she? I'm shocked that she lets you out of her sight. Maybe you'd better run on back to her.
I don't understand why you're mad, Hay said, frustrated and unwilling to bear her anger. You're the one who didn't want me.
I had no choice. I had my brother and sister to see to. There was the accident to deal with, or do you blame me for that?
Franny stood up with the intention of leaving. When Hay took her arm, she glared at him. But he was looking at her the way he used to, when he was the only person in the world who really knew her.
"Don't go yet," he said.
"Why? You're with Emily."
"I am," Halen said.
"And you blame me for that, too?"
She was heartless. The Maid of Thorns.
Halen shook his head.
If only he would stop looking at her like that. So she took it further.
"Well, I'm glad you're with her," Franny said. "You'll be happier than you would have ever been with me. She's normal."
Lewis was perched above them, ever vigilant, upset they were arguing. Hay called the bird to him, and the crow skimmed the air and came to perch on the rock. He gazed at Franny for too long, and just when it seemed he might say something that would change their path, he snapped out of it.
"I should probably leave Lewis with you. I don't really have time for a pet."
"I've told you, he's not a pet. He comes and goes as he pleases, isn't it clear? He's chosen you, Halen. I don't blame him."
"Well, he can't stay with me anymore. Emily has a fear of birds."
"What if she does?"
"We live together in New Haven."
"Then what are you doing here?"
He looked at her, but she simply stared. She wanted him to say it. "I'm here for you."
"But you live with her."
"What should I have done? You never answered any of my letters. I thought you hated me because we were together when the accident happened."
"What's done is done. I don't think either one of us should come here anymore."
He had made his choice, Franny thought. Emily. And there was the curse to protect him from. She refused to be responsible for any of his sorrow.
"We were young, and now we're not."
Halen laughed a short, unhappy laugh. His shoulders were hunched the way they were when he sulked. "We're 24, Franny, for Christ's sake. We have our whole lives to live. You're going to let me marry her? Is that what you want?"
"Apparently, that's what you want."
When she walked away, she felt as though she were falling. It seemed as if the world was a snow globe that had been shaken, and where she'd ended up had nothing to do with where she had begun. When she reached the zoo, Franny stopped and sat on a bench, with Lewis perched beside her.
"I suppose you're mine," she told him.
In response, he did the oddest thing. He sat on her lap and let her pet him, something he'd never done before. He made a funny clacking noise, then took to the sky. Was he letting her know that if she ran, she could catch up with Halen? She knew the paths he took to cut across the park. But his life was set out before him, and he would be better off without her. And because she still had no idea how to break the curse, Franny walked home, 4 miles as the crow flies. When she reached 44 Greenwich Avenue, she went inside alone, and only the crow knew that it was possible for a woman to claim to have no heart at all and still cry as though her heart would break. Vincent and William flew to San Francisco, a city cast out of a dream. It was the summer of love. Free love and a free society had called 100,000 people to the city. There were indeed flowers everywhere, and along the bay the scent of patchouli and chocolate infused the air. Strangers embraced them as they walked down Haight Street. In Manhattan, theirs was a secret society, but here the doors were open to everyone. They camped out in Golden Gate Park, surrounded by eucalyptus trees, and when a pale, mossy rain began, they raced for the shelter of the public library. There in the stacks, they met a couple who invited them to their apartment in the Mission, where they spent the night on a quilt on the floor, entwined and madly in love. It was true, Vincent was in love, despite the warnings, despite the world, despite himself. This was what he had seen in the mirror in his aunt's greenhouse, the image that had terrified him because from that moment he knew what he wanted. A life he thought he'd never have, and now, at last, he did. In the morning they were given a breakfast of toast and honey butter and orange tea. "Are you always so kind to strangers?" William asked their hosts.
"You're not strangers,"
they were told. And it seemed in this city, at this time, they were embraced by those who saw them for who they were. They rode around in a convertible Mustang, borrowed from a cousin of William's who lived in Mill Valley. The cousin had informed them California was not like New York. They did not need to keep themselves hidden. They had the nerve to kiss on a dock with a view of Alcatraz and the bright blue water of the bay. They went to clubs in the Castro district where they felt completely at home dancing until they were exhausted. They drove along in the pale light of dawn in an ecstasy of freedom. Magic was everywhere. They spied people wearing feathers and bells on Mount Tamalpais, and in cafes in the North End, and all along Divisadero Street, where young girls handed out magical ceramic talismans in the shape of a triangle or an eye. "Blessed be," they called. And indeed, Vincent and William felt blessed to be in California. In Monterey, they slept in a cabin overlooking the ocean and made love in the blaze of the pure yellow sunlight and felt something dark lift away from them. They had been hidden, casting a clouding spell wherever they went in New York, but they would do that no longer. It was the end of secrets, the end of lies, the beginning of everything they did not yet know. Something was about to happen. They could both feel it. Vincent thought about the black mirror in his aunt's greenhouse. There had been so many images, but now as his future became his present, he recognized the visions he had seen. William was acquainted with a publicist working for the record producer Lou Adler, who had come up with the idea for the Monterey Pop Festival, held on the weekend of June 16, 1967, inviting the Grateful Dead and Janis Joplin and The Who and Jimi Hendrix and Otis Redding and many others for 3 days of music and love and peace. Somehow William had talked his friend into letting Vincent perform. When Vincent heard the news, he hesitated. He was a street singer, not meant for large venues. But in the end, he was talked into it, and William slipped a roadie $10 so Vincent could use a guitar. He wore black and took off his boots and socks. William placed a wreath of leaves on his head just before he went onto the stage. It was an odd hour, dusk, a dim, murky time no one wanted to claim on the stage. So there he was, a nobody, Vincent and a borrowed guitar. No one knew him. No one cared. He seemed calm if you didn't look too closely at his beautiful, worried face. When he began, people had their backs to him, but the microphone was turned up suddenly, by William's hand, no doubt, and Vincent's soaring voice drifted over the crowd as though it were an enchantment. A quiet fell as darkness sifted down from the trees. "When I was yours, who was I then? I heard your voice, but that was when I had a heart, I had a harp. I had your love, the knife was sharp. I walked at night, I longed to fight. Isn't that what betrayal is? Isn't that when fear exists? When you hide who you are and you take it too far, when you're a man. I called on angels when I faced a wall, but just like Joshua's, it began to fall. I cried blood-red tears despite my fears. Isn't that what betrayal is? Isn't that when fear exists? I walked at night, I had the sight, and still I lost despite the call. I walk at night without a fight. I've tried before, I've locked the door, I've done it wrong, I've done it right." Afterward, there was a moment of silence, then a huge wave of applause. William took Vincent's arm as they ducked behind the stage. "Man, you cast a spell," one of the promoters said to him, but Vincent paid no attention. He was looking beyond those crowding around him. A little girl with gray eyes was standing in the yellow grass. Hadn't he seen her before? He left the business of saying goodbye to William and went over to the child. "I know you," he said.
"I know you back," she piped up.
She was Regina Owens, now 6 years old. Her mother, April, was behind her, her pale hair so long she could sit on it if she pleased, her skin tanned from her time in the desert. She looked like a creature that couldn't possibly be part of the mortal world.
"My dear cousin," she said, embracing Vincent.
William, never shy, came to introduce himself. April looked at him, then at Vincent. She smiled slyly.
I see who you are now that you're a man. Let me guess. This was the date for which you couldn't be late. He certainly had me fooled.
I thought no one could do that, Vincent remarked.
You always blocked me, April said with a measure of sadness.
You're related, William said, wanting to break the tension between these two. I can tell by the eyes.
Distantly, Vincent said as he accepted some daisies Regina had picked.
Several times removed, probably by hacksaw. He grinned, and April grinned back at him.
No, by carving knife, she said prettily. That's the way an Owens removes you from his life.
April and Regina were currently living in Santa Cruz, in a small wood-shingled cottage that was provided when April found employment as the gardener and housekeeper on the estate of the owners, wealthy San Franciscans who wanted to be closer to nature, but hardly ever got out of the city. She planned to return to the desert to attend to her research with spiders, but for now, Regina needed school and the companionship of other children.
Stay with us tonight, April insisted.
We so rarely have interesting guests. You're here, we're here. Clearly it was meant to be. Regina had taken hold of Vincent's hand. Because of the weight and heat of her small hand in his, he didn't say no. April had hitchhiked to Monterey with her daughter, so they drove back in the borrowed Mustang, top down. While they sped along the curving highway, William slipped a recording he'd made into the tape player.
You made a tape? Vincent asked William. I wanted to save the moment, and maybe send it to a radio station.
No, Vincent said. He knew where fame would lead him, to the darkest side of himself. It was something he didn't need. April leaned forward, her arms on the edges of their seats. She held her hair back from her face with one hand, intent on the song. Saul went down to the oldest road to meet the Witch of Endor. She spoke, but he couldn't hear. She saw his fate, but he had no fear. No predictions could make him stay. He was told the truth, but still he strayed. Isn't that what love makes you do? Go on trying, even when you're through. Go on, even when you're made of ash, when there's nothing left inside you but the past. When I was yours, who was I then? I heard your voice, but that was when I had a heart, I had a harp. I had your love, the knife was sharp. I walked at night, I cared with all my might. Isn't that what betrayal is? Isn't that when fear exists? Isn't that what happens when you hide who you are? Even love can't take you that far, when you were a man.
Who was the Witch of Endor? Regina asked her mother.
A wise old woman who could foretell the future.
Could she really see a person's fate?
Fate is what you make of it, my aunt always says. You can make the best of it, or you can let it make the best of you. My cousin knows that. He loved to get the best of other people.
William was driving, and therefore didn't see the worried expression cross Vincent's face. There was something in April's knowing tone that made him uncomfortable. In Santa Cruz, they had dinner outside, at a weathered wooden table set beneath a trellis teeming with flowering vines. The pale blooms gave off the bittersweet scent of almonds, reminding Vincent of their aunt's greenhouse.
"It's so familiar," he said.
"Oleander," April responded.
"It's poisonous."
She had been inspired by the greenhouse in Isabel's garden and grew herbs that weren't native to California. As a girl, April couldn't wait to leave home, yet now she favored wildflowers that could be found when traipsing through the woods in Massachusetts. Sunflower, wild bean, wintergreen, blue flag used for skin conditions, blue vervain for headache and fever, cardinal plant appreciated by the native people as a love charm, skullcap for nervous conditions. She asked Regina to give William a tour of the greenhouse so he could see for himself. Vincent stood, about to join in, but April caught his eye and gestured for him to stay.
"Don't leave, cousin,"
It's been too long since we've spoken. He felt he had no choice but to sink back into his chair, though he had a feeling of dread. April was a wild card. You never knew what she'd do or say. Now, for instance, as soon as William and Regina were out of earshot, she turned to Vincent. You know, don't you? April, don't play games. Vincent stretched out his long legs. He was all in black and he'd kicked off his shoes. He realized that he felt more at home singing in a subway station or in the park on a summer evening than he had in Monterey. All that time of playing around with the Magus, thinking he sought fame, and now it was the last thing he wanted. He was rattled by the festival, and had little patience for April's mockery. Your charm was always telling it like it is. Well, you always knew what your charm was, especially that summer when you were 14 and fucking everything in sight. Of course, this was before you knew who you preferred. April gazed searchingly after William, who was bending down to fit his tall frame through the pitched doorway of the greenhouse. He was so courteous, listening to Regina's ongoing lecture concerning the uses of poisonous plants. Vincent, too, watched William, intent on his form. He had a masculine grace that was enchanting. I don't care what you think about me and William. So if you want to make nasty remarks, go right ahead. It will feel like old times. April reached over and took Vincent's hand. Tell me you don't remember. He looked at her blankly. Family was always such a bother. April raised an eyebrow, disappointed in his lack of recollection. I came to your room. Into your bed. It had happened on a night when there was a rainstorm, when the sparrows took shelter in the branches of lilacs below the window. They'd told no one, and had never even spoken of it afterward. Oh, that, Vincent said. He remembered now, of course. A quick, crazy fuck with their hands over each other's mouths so no one would hear the heat of their sudden passion. Their aunt had given him a disquieting look in the morning, but his sisters, prescient as they were, seemed to have no idea of what had gone on. "We are extremely distant from each other in the family tree," April went on. "Third cousins, twice removed. It's fine, genetically." She studied his puzzled face and laughed. He had no idea what she was getting at. "You really don't know. And you're supposed to be the one with the sight." "It just goes to show, people see what they want to see." "April," Vincent said. "Don't fuck around with me." "I think it was quite the opposite. You were the one fucking with me, darling." Annoyed, Vincent stood, making haste to follow William, but before he could, April reached for him. Her tentative touch made him stay. She was emotionally raw, something he hadn't thought was in her nature. Although she had been so vulnerable when she'd come to visit them after the summer, running off before they'd spoken. "All right, then," April said. "Perhaps you are clueless. Well, here it is, my dear. She's yours." Bewildered, Vincent watched the little girl in the greenhouse. She was gathering purple echinacea flowers for William. They had grown almost wild in Aunt Isabel's garden, and had been used throughout time as a cure for scarlet fever, malaria, diphtheria, blood poisoning, and the common cold. Regina laughed as William accepted her gift, then bowed. "Can't you see yourself in her?" April asked. "You said her father drowned." "What was I to say? That I fucked a distant cousin who was 14 and too stupid to use a condom? And now here she is. An amazing child we share. A double bloodline. The problem is, I think she may live twice as fast. I saw it when she was an infant, and I think Franny did as well when I came to visit." "Franny?" He had a flicker of panic. "Don't worry. She doesn't know you're the father. That spell we placed on her in the library so she wouldn't know what we were doing lasted. But she knows the fate. Something our girl has inherited. From both of us, really. A lifeline that is regrettably short." Vincent was stricken. You know that for a fact? April dissolved into tears.
I'm giving her the best life I can. She'll grow up, I know that much, and really, who knows how much time anyone has.
What will you tell her? Vincent leaned forward into the last rays of yellow light. About me.
I'll tell her you're a very special cousin.
Vincent nodded. His grief was in his expression.
It's too late to have regrets, April said.
Maybe I should have told you, but you were hardly interested in such things. You were a boy.
Life is a mess. That's what Isabel told me when I decided to have the child. But all we can do is live it. She was right. I'm glad at last you fell in love.
You know that's impossible for us, Vincent reminded her.
Bullshit,
April said. For she had been in love with him that summer.
Her first and only true love, as a matter of fact, and nothing horrible had happened.
Instead, something wonderful had occurred.
Their daughter.
We just have to fight harder for what we want.
William and Regina approached the patio, holding hands and singing their own version of I Walk at Night. William carried the bunch of cut flowers with their purple-red blooms.
I had a garden, I had a dove, I had a tree, I had your love.
Let's bring out dessert, April said. If I'd known you were coming, I would have made Auntie Isabel's tipsy chocolate cake. Instead, we have a raspberry mousse.
I thought you were making macarons,
Regina said, for those were her favorites.
Vincent and William would love them.
Not enough time,
April informed the sad little girl.
Someday we'll have macarons from Paris, Vincent said to cheer her. But tonight we're having a mousse for dessert, and I want the antlers.
Regina laughed as she climbed onto his lap, a child who was completely comfortable with who she was.
Sing to me, she said. I want to remember you when you're gone.
Vincent smoothed down her hair. It was black, like his, straight as sticks. And her smile could undo a person. At least it had done so to him. I'll send you a tape, William assured the little girl. Or even better, I'll have it made into a record.
Regina clapped her hands happily and said, Then I'll play it every night when we get a record player.
We'll send you one of those as well, Vincent told her.
Do me a favor, April said.
She had reappeared with their dessert and some coffees and had overheard his promises. She knew Vincent as well as anyone, and she knew how easy it was for him to forget something that was terribly important to someone else. The smell of the dessert's berries and sugar was so intoxicating bees gathered around, and April had to bat them away with her hand.
Don't make promises you can't keep.
Jet took the bus without telling anyone. It was the 1st of March, Levi's birthday, and the forsythia was blooming. She wore her black dress and tied a scarf over her head. She had her purse and nothing else. She had discussed coming here with Raphael when he'd surprised her by reserving a room at the Plaza Hotel for a night. When the elevator opened at the 7th floor, Jet realized he had asked for room 708, and she said she would prefer if they could have a different room. One that was their own.
What we are is separate from Levi, she'd said. Even if I go to visit his grave, it has nothing to do with us.
When she got off the bus, she walked to the west, stopping in a field to collect some daffodils that were the color of new butter. She tied a bunch together with blue string. The sun was pale and the air was cool and fresh. It was 2 miles out to the cemetery and she walked quickly. Ducking behind greenery each time a car passed by. At the cemetery gates, a waiting hearse idled, which gave her pause, but the funeral that had taken place had ended, and there was no one in sight when the hearse pulled away. There were many surnames she recognized in the older section of the cemetery, Porter and Coker and Putnam and Shepherd.
People had been called wrestling and valor and worth and redeemed, for it was those virtues their families hoped they would possess. When Jet neared the graves of the Willard family, she came upon an angel marking the resting place of a baby named Resign Willard, who had lived for one day. Levi's grave was in a newer section beyond a huge field of grass. She set the daffodils in front of the simple stone that had been placed in the ground. He had been 18, barely a life. Suddenly exhausted, Jet lay down on the grass beside him. She still wore the ring Levi had given her, even though the moment when he told her to close her eyes so he could give her this birthday gift felt so far away. They had likely been together 20 times, an entire world created in just days. She imagined Levi next to her in his black jacket. Many of the Hathorne family had been buried nearby. They were her family as well as his, a fact that was terribly uncomfortable. No wonder the Owens family had kept this secret. No wonder so many had fled Massachusetts. Even the witch hunter's own relation, Nathaniel Hawthorne, had placed the W in his name to distance himself from his cruel ancestor, his writing driven by his desire to make amends for all the evil his great-great-grandfather had done in the world. Not far from here was a tree where the witches were hung, sentenced by the man who had been the father of Maria Owens's child. In 1692, he had been appointed chief examiner of the witch trials. He had sentenced and overseen the hanging of 19 innocent people, convincing the court to accept spectral evidence, which meant what was said was gospel without any proof. Women could turn into crows. A man could be the devil's apprentice. His cruelty was legendary. He refused to hear recanted testimonies, concluding those accused were guilty before they were tried, badgering the accused, causing them to be murdered, thereby setting upon himself and all that followed him the curse they now shared. After a conviction, property could be taken and distributed as the judges saw fit. Hathorne had married a Quaker girl of 14 years of age, built a mansion, and fathered 6 children. He did as he wished to Maria Owens, who was without parents or guardians, using her as he saw fit, and in her youth and inexperience she believed she loved him. But it was as a crow loved his cage. Jet shaded her eyes and looked into the sky. She saw that a man was watching her and quickly scrambled to her feet. Her heart was pounding. She was so close to the hanging tree she felt dizzy. She had the blood of both accuser and accused running through her. The man stayed where he was. He was carrying a bunch of daffodils. They stared at each other, the only people in the cemetery. Before the reverend could come any closer and chastise her, and call out that she was a witch and a demon, and had caused his son to die, Jet took off running. She ran so fast all she could hear was the blood pounding in her ears. She wanted to be dead and be beside Levi, but she was alive, and so she ran. She didn't stop in town. She didn't wait for a bus. Instead, she found her way to Magnolia Street. She knocked on Aunt Isabel's door. The light was on, but no one answered, so she went round to the garden. Isabel was in the greenhouse, beginning her seedlings. She didn't seem the least surprised to see her niece on the threshold. "You could have come here if you wanted daffodils," she said when Jet walked in. True enough, the yard was thick with them at this time of year, a sea of yellow. Jet saw that the garden was far ahead of the rest of town. The wisteria was already blooming, the climbing roses were budding. "Looks as though you saw a ghost," Isabel said. "I saw Levi's father." "That reverend doesn't own the cemetery, and he doesn't own this town. You have your right to Levi's memory." "I want to get rid of it," Jet said.
"Do you?"
"I want to have no memory of him. Please," she said to her aunt, "please do this for me. I know you can do things like that, and I can pay you." Jet was in tears.
"Jet, if I did that, then you wouldn't be you."
"Good. I don't want to be me."
Jet had come to sit on a wooden bench, her hands folded on her lap.
I let Franny think I drank courage.
But you did, her aunt said. Isabel signaled for Jet to follow her back to the house. There was a woman pacing on the porch. She stopped when she saw Isabel.
Oh, Miss Owens, she said, if you could spare me a moment.
You'll have to wait, Isabel told her. Just sit down and be quiet. Jet followed her aunt into the kitchen, where Isabel put up the kettle.
I don't want to keep that woman waiting,
Jet said. She's waited 20 years for her husband to love her. She can wait another 20 minutes. When the tea was brewed, they both sat down and had a cup.
Taste familiar?
Isabel asked.
It's what I had before.
You asked for caution, but I gave you this. It was what you needed.
And it's what you have.
Jet laughed and drank the rest of the tea. Was this what courage felt like?
Once you forget a piece of your past, you forget it all. That's not what you want, dear.
Jet went to embrace her aunt, who was surprised by the unexpected show of emotion.
I have a client, Isabel said.
Time for you to go.
Will her husband love her?
Would you want love you had to buy? Isabel asked. Isabel then called Charlie Merrill, who came in his old station wagon to give Jet a ride to the bus station. As they drove, Jet asked if he would take a detour. The cemetery gates were closed, but Charlie knew the trick to picking the lock with a screwdriver. He pushed the gates open for her and waited in his car, happy to listen to a basketball game on the radio. It was nearly dark, and Jet was glad she knew the way. She cut across the grass, luminous in the fading light. She was entitled to her memory and to this place.
Here lies the life I might have had once upon a time. The man I might have loved for all my life. The days we might have had.
Jet went to his headstone and knelt down. There were 2 bunches of daffodils. The Reverend hadn't thrown hers away. She lay down beside him once more, and this time she told him she would never forgive the world for taking him, but she had no choice but to go on. She was alive. She walked back in the pitch dark, glad she could see Charlie's headlights cutting through the night.
Everything all right?
Charlie Merrill said when she climbed back into the car. It smelled like cough drops and flannel. Jet nodded.
I think I'll go to the bus station now.
He drove her there in time for the last bus. When he pulled over, Charlie handed her a paper bag. Inside was a small thermos and something wrapped in wax paper.
Your aunt sent along some tea. I think there's some cake in there, too.
Jet threw her arms around the old man, utterly surprising him.
She's a good lady, he said, as if explaining her aunt to her. Anyone who knows her knows that.
He waited, his car idling, until the bus pulled away. It was likely Isabel told him to do so, and he always did as she asked. His 2 boys had been heroin addicts. One was in prison by the time he was 20. The other went half mad with drugs. She'd fixed them both with one of those mixtures of hers. Afterward, there'd been a knock at their door, even though everyone knew Isabel Owens didn't call on people. She came to see the boys every night for 2 weeks, watching over his grown sons as if they were babies until they were well again. She charged him nothing for doing so. Now when his sons saw her on the street or when they were working on her house and she looked in on them, the boys would elbow each other and stand up straight. They were still afraid of her, even though she'd sat by their beds and fed them soup with a teaspoon. So Charlie stayed and waved as Jet got on the bus, and Jet waved back, and when she realized she was starving and hadn't eaten all day, she was glad to have the chocolate cake her aunt had sent along, and grateful to have been convinced that forgetting her loss would be worse than the loss itself. So she sat there remembering everything, from the beginning of her life to today. By the time she recalled the pale yellow of the daffodils she'd picked that morning, she had reached New York. The announcement was in the New York Times on March 21st, Franny's birthday,
a day that had always proved inauspicious. It was the unluckiest day of the year, but it was also the day to celebrate Ostara, the spring equinox, when eggshells must be scattered in a garden, for new growth and transformation.